But it's not just for academics. I really worked with my writers to develop their chapters to be written in sort of a friendly way.
This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, author of The Misquotable C.S. Lewis, scheduled for release by May 2018. On the show today is Serena Higgins, who has been on the podcast several times in a variety of roles that include being one of the speakers in a 2016 highlights episode of Keynote Speakers from the Taylor Colloquium and a program that shared a panel discussion from that same event. She is back today to talk about a title she edited called The Inklings and King Author. Welcome back to All About Jack, Serena.
Thank you very much, William. I'm very glad to be here talking with you today.
Well, obviously you have an interest in King Author, and I'm sure those listening to the show probably do. However, for some who might be like myself and have only a passing knowledge of King Author, let's begin with a twofold question. How did you become interested in King Author, and why put together a book on the topic as it relates to the Inklings?
Right. That's an interesting twofold question because it gets to the two subjects that are being woven together in this book. Well, I think I've just been interested in King Arthur the way most kids are, watching The Sword and the Stone, reading Roger Lancelin Green, later reading T.H. White, just fascinated by this story and the way that it changes throughout literary history. And it takes on so many different shapes and pulls all these other stories into itself. It's a really large complex of different narratives, and it can suit any time period, any culture in which it's adapted. So then, why put together a book on this topic related to the Inklings? Well, here's how that happened. In 2013, J.R.R. Tolkien's book, The Fall of Arthur, was published. Now, previously we knew that he had started and abandoned a poem on King Arthur, but we really did not know how extensive it was. We didn't know how much he had written or how much had survived. We had just heard some references to it in Humphrey Carpenter's works and elsewhere. Well, then this book was published in 2013, and it's quite a sizable work. It's a large poem in several cantos, and he's retelling the King Arthur story in an alliterative meter in a kind of Germanic mode. Well, I was very excited when I saw that because then it showed that each of the major Inklings had written something on King Arthur. I wasn't sure yet how much Owen Barfield had written, but I knew that then C.S. Lewis had several poems on King Arthur, as well as obviously That Hideous Strength, where Merlin appears, and some Arthurian elements in the Narnia Chronicles. And obviously Charles Williams shaped his life work around the Arthurian stories. He continued to try to write different versions of it all throughout his life. And then I discovered that Owen Barfield did have a few short but important Arthurian works. And so voila, it was obvious that someone had to write or edit a book drawing together the works from these four authors and some of their other major influences and contemporaries. So that's how it got started.
Ah, quite interesting. Well, now, The Inklings and King Arthur is no small book. There are a list of 19 chapters, if I'm correct. Then there's an introduction and a conclusion that make up the 500-plus pages. Now, how did you go about deciding who might contribute to this massive project?
We did sort of the ordinary academic procedure, which is I began with a call for papers. So I wrote up a description of how I thought the project might evolve and publicized that on as many of the Inklings-related channels and other academic channels as I could. So it was an open call for papers. Plus, I also wrote to certain individuals whom I thought might be good contributors. So they all sent in their proposals, their abstracts. And then I assembled a team of peer reviewers. So I got other scholars in the field who had not submitted chapters, and they mostly anonymously reviewed those abstracts and made recommendations to me about which papers they thought I should include. And then from there, we invited those people to write their chapters. And then, of course, it was a long process of drafts being sent, further revisions to papers, more peer reviewing. So that we ended up with this really sizable scholarly collection. Of course, it was very hard to decide what to put in and what not to put in. We had other excellent, excellent proposals that maybe just didn't fit the way the book was shaping up. We sometimes had two proposals on almost exactly the same topic. Those were sometimes hard to choose between. But that's how we decided who would contribute, was through the peer review process and through my editorial decisions about how to shape the themes and the overall trajectory of the book.
And then, of course, since we live in the electronic age and this is all you do is just think of great things to put out, this is what took about 5 weeks to throw together?
Yeah, it was a pretty short project like that. No, it was about 4.5 years from the call for papers till when the book appeared. I should also say one other way that I decided who would contribute was that I really wanted a broad spectrum of perspectives on the material. I wanted well-known scholars in the field. So I have, for instance, Holly Ordway, Charles Hutter, and Malcolm Guite. And then I also wanted emerging voices, people who perhaps hadn't published before, younger scholars or people just beginning their academic career, and even a couple people outside of academia or independent scholars, and as far as possible, international voices as well. So that also went into the decision making.
The book is divided into 5 major sections. First, did that come naturally at the beginning of the process? And secondly, did you ever consider making this a series of books given the amount of material you gathered or could have even published?
Yeah, the idea of dividing into sections came fairly early, but I wasn't sure what those sections would be until I had the final versions of the paper in hand. Obviously, I could have organized it in a much simpler way, like by author. We could have had a C.S. Lewis section, a Tolkien section, a Williams section, Barfield section, another one on influences or something like that. But that didn't really work well because it would have led to so much repetition within the sections. And also we have several overview survey chapters that consider all the authors together from one point of view. So that led to moving away from the author organization. It also would not have been simple to organize it by chronology from the works considered, again, because chapters consider so many different works, and many of their books were written over a long period of time throughout their lives. So the themes started to emerge pretty early in the process. I knew there would have to be a section about geography, because maps are very important to these writers, and they ground their Arthurian works in particular geographical places, whether these are real places in the primary world or whether these are places in their secondary worlds that they've imagined. And I knew I wanted to have some new theoretical or critical perspectives, so I thought there would probably be a section on gender and probably a section from a post-colonial approach as well. So those led to the sections. Now, I never considered making it a series of books, but at one stage, the publisher discussed the possibility of breaking it into 2 volumes when we were looking at the typesetting, because the way he originally wanted to typeset it, it would have run to over 1,000 pages, and he just couldn't bind a paperback book that big. But then we looked into changing the dimensions of the book. So those of you who have already held a paper copy will see it's kind of cool dimensions. It's not the usual golden proportion of your average book. It's a bit more square. I think it's very pretty that way. So we looked at some formatting and typesetting things that enabled us to get it down to only 566 pages.
So it's a great way to do some weightlifting exercises too then.
That is. So that means everyone needs to get 2 copies. You can have one in each hand.
Now, let's go ahead and consider the text itself. Let's explore each of those parts briefly. The first section is called Text and Intertext. Either highlight each or most of the 5 chapters that are in that part, or go into detail about 1 or 2 of them.
Sure. So each of these major sections begins with a chapter that is an overview of the content to come. That's especially true in the first 3. So this one begins with my chapter in which I give an overview of, well, what Arthurian works did each of the Inklings write? And what are the themes in those works? What are they doing to the story? And then the next one is also a survey chapter by Holly Ordway about the medieval Arthurian sources that the Inklings were using. So those 2 chapters together are a really good introduction, especially for readers who might not be as familiar with the Arthurian materials at all. You could even start with Holly Ordway's to get the source overview and then read my chapter next to see, well, then what did the Inklings write? But then we get into the important theory in this section, which is the theory of intertextuality. And this is an investigation into the ways that books or any works of literature or culture interact with earlier ones. Do they quote from the earlier works? Do they allude to them? Do they adapt them? How are they in conversation or dialogue? So Brenton Dickinson's chapter is a study of C.S. Lewis's intertextuality. And I'll just pick out one important element of his chapter. He deals with the concept of hypertexts and hypotexts. The hypotext would be the older work, so say Malory or Geoffrey of Monmouth or Chrétien de Troyes' Arthurian stories. And then the hypertext is the later one, the one on top. So C.S. Lewis's That Hideous Strength. But Brenton talks about how in our digital age, hypertext has taken on another meaning. It's a link, right? It's a URL. You double click on it and something pops open. So the idea is if you're reading along in Charles Williams's poetry and you see the word sorus, you mentally, quote unquote, double click on that word. And you open up, as it were, a mental window to all the other authors who have written about that place. It's the land of the Trinity. It's where the Holy Grail is kept. It's this mystical, spiritual location that sort of is an emblem of heaven on earth. So you kind of get this double-click effect when you look at those words. And Brenton argues that what the Inklings do is they enable you to double-click on those words and open a whole other imaginary world, a whole other secondary world. So he's laying some really important foundations for future studies of intertextuality. And then the next two chapters by Charles Hutter and Christopher Gertner do that. They double-click on a particular word or concept and then drill down into it and explore it. So that's the first section, which is a big, heavy section, and it's theoretically important. It's paving new ground. That's a very meaty section in the book.
Well, now the second section is called History's Past. What can you tell us about this part?
This is the only section of the book that explores at all the question of, was there an historical King Arthur? Was there an actual guy named Arthur who fought the Anglo-Saxons? But that's not really the important focus of this section. The more important focus is, what is the interaction of history and myth? How do those two blend together? How do they redefine each other and interact? What were the thoughts that were going on about history and mythology in the early 20th century when the Inklings were writing? And then how did the Inklings adapt either a legendary or a historical Arthur? And what does this say about their view of history and myth? So that's what that section does.
All right. Well, then logically, the next section is History's Present. There are four chapters in this part. Either share highlights or more details about a few of them.
I'm glad you think that it follows logically. I was hoping so, because we're looking at what was Arthur's past, and then we're looking at how were the Inklings writing into their historical moment. So Lewis and Tolkien were both war veterans. They both fought in different phases of the Battle of the Somme in World War I. Charles Williams was not able to fight because of poor vision and a neurological disorder, but he experienced what we now might call survivor's grief when his best friends went off and were killed in the war. Owen Barfield also had some war duties. I believe they were all on the home front, but they were all affected by this. So it's natural to think that the war would make its way into their writings. So then when they're writing about King Arthur, a military general, a commander-in-chief, it's not surprising that their war experiences would come into their writings. So we have a couple of chapters about the fall of Arthur and its interaction with World War I, and Narnia and its interaction with World War II, and then Charles Williams' works and the rhetoric of empire that was going on at the time. We also have a larger survey chapter by Jason Jewell and Chris Butinsky that talks about the ideas of scientistic materialism that were going on at the time, and Darwin and Freud and Nietzsche, and how the Inklings were interacting with those writers and also providing an alternative vision. This is a really important section because in a previous generation of scholarship, the Inklings were written off as being backwards looking, not connected to their times, these sort of bourgeois, snobby chauvinists who weren't really connected to the problems of their times. And recent scholarship is showing how that is not true, how deeply they were involved with the modern writers of their times, with political questions that were going on. So that this section is important from that point of view.
You already made a passing reference to geographies. The fourth part, is geographies of gender. Well, now this explores an obvious topic, but do these three chapters present it in the typical way?
That's a really good question. And To answer it, I think I'll say I'm not exactly sure which of the two topics is the obvious one, the geographies or the gender, because the Inklings are doing surprising things with both of those. The most surprising is very literal and very visual. Some of you might know that in his 1938 poetry collection, Taliesin Through Logres, Charles Williams included a map of Europe, and he got an artist at Oxford University Press, Linton Lamb, to draw up this map of Europe and then draw the figure of a nude woman over the map of Europe such that the different parts of her anatomy match up with the different regions or countries in Europe. And then throughout the poetry, he refers to the different parts of the body as emblems for those different countries, and they're also representative of zodiac signs and of different virtues that he associates with these different regions. So he's doing something very non-typical, very strange. It comes from the occult tradition in which he was steeped, but it also raises some questions. It's problematic to associate a woman with empire, and then this brings up questions of the subaltern, the slave master relationship, the colonizer and the colonized. And there are many areas of concern about the way the Inklings write gender. So these chapters dive right into those problems. Alyssa House Thomas's deals with Guinevere in Tolkien's Fall of Arthur, and she does a source criticism approach. She talks about the different Celtic and Germanic sources that Tolkien used for shaping his Guinevere. And his Guinevere, for those of you who haven't read it, is a remarkable character. She really stands out in the Tolkien canon as being a very strong and independent character, but also very conflicted. And she's a villain in the piece. But Tolkien explores her sexuality and her greed and her selfishness in some pretty bold ways that he doesn't always do with his idealized women in some of his other works. So Alyssa's chapter pushes that conversation forward in important ways. And then Andrew Rasmussen looks at gender in Charles Williams, which is a very conflicted topic. And he deals with some biographical elements as well as the poetry. And then Benjamin Shogren looks at gender in That Hideous Strength and looks at the emblems. Lewis is dealing with a sort of essentialist concept of gender, not as it relates specifically to humans, but as it's a spiritual archetype. And so Shogren's chapter goes into how that plays out in the Arthurian sources and in That Hideous Strength. So I will say that these three chapters, especially those latter two, are quite controversial. And if there are parts of the book that are going to spark debate, I imagine it would be those two most of all. And I really look forward to those important ongoing conversations. I don't think that there are really easy and simple answers about what the Inklings are doing with gender. And I think we need to keep debating about that.
Yeah, it should prove very interesting what comes out of it.
I hope so.
Well, now, the fifth and final section, Cartographies of the Spirit, may not make sense to some at first, but obviously you felt the material was vital to this collection. What do you want the listener to know about these four chapters?
I want the listener to think about the fact that I have not yet mentioned the Holy Grail, and that is absolutely essential to the Inklings' vision of what they're doing with the King Arthur story. So the title of this section, Cartographies of the Spirit, it picks up again the idea of maps, geography, and places, but it looks at them more subspecie eternitatis, looking at them from the perspective of eternity or from a heavenly perspective. So we have a chapter on George MacDonald and on spiritual pilgrimages and the way they change someone into being the ideal knight. We have chapters on Charles Williams's theology of work and on his Holy Grail. And this section is very heavily weighted towards Williams, and that makes perfect sense because he wrote the most Arthurian works and the greatest number of completed Arthurian works, but he's also the one who wrote these sizable arguments for the centrality of the Holy Grail in the myth. The Holy Grail works in the myth kind of the way a crime does in a murder mystery. So think of Broadchurch or something like that, where this crime is committed, and then the way it works throughout the story is that it reveals each character's true nature. It reveals the secrets they've tried to hide in the past. It reveals these sides of themselves they've tried to keep hidden. So for Williams, the Grail does the same thing. The way that people choose to pursue it and to interact with it reveals their true spiritual condition, whether they greedily try to hoard it for themselves, whether they try to use it as an instrument of evil, or whether they just submit themselves to it in a very gentle way, and this the submitted saint who sort of thinks, this is not for me, but I am here to serve this. So that comes into these chapters about the significance of the Grail in his novels, in his plays, and in his poetry.
Well, let's take a break for a moment from the book, and for those who don't know you very well, tell us who Serena Higgins is, including a few details about other books you've been involved in publishing, and your website.
Oh, well, thanks. There are kind of two of me. There's the one that those of you in the Inklings world may know better. That's the work that I've been doing for the past decade and more. I was able to publish an edition of Charles Williams' The Chapel of the Thorn, an early play. I got to write an introduction to Taliesin Through Logres, which, by the way, Apocryphile Press is going to be issuing an expanded edition that covers the region of the Summer Stars as well in a hardback edition in the near future. And then this project. And I work at Signum University Online. I'm the chair of the Language and Literature Department there, and we offer a Master of Arts with a focus in Tolkien studies for those who are interested. Also other fields, imaginative literature, Germanic philology, and classic literature. So that's the Serena Higgins that most of you might know, but then there's the new me. I'm pursuing a PhD at Baylor University right now, and I'm shifting my focus a little bit. The Inklings will still come into it in a smaller way, but my dissertation topic looks like it's going to be about magic and theater in Britain and Ireland in the first half of the 20th century. There were about a half a dozen playwrights who were also practicing magicians in these high ritual secret societies like the Order of the Golden Dawn and the Fellowship of the Rosy Cross. And there's evidence that the rituals they were performing in secret had a great influence on the plays they were writing and staging at the time, such that they were actually staging secret magic in public places. So I'm interested in looking into how this interacts with scientific and political and cultural shifts at the time, and examining the plays of Yeats, Williams, and others at the time.
Oh, okay. Well, that's rather interesting. And your website, I don't think you've yet mentioned that.
Ah, right. Yes. Well, I have The Oddest Inkling, which is my blog about Charles Williams. That's been a bit of a hiatus. I might revive it this summer. We'll see. And then people can just find me through SerenaHiggins.com, which also needs to be updated.
Ah, yes. I was going to joke and say you probably need a new website called SerenaHigginsIsVeryBusy.com.
Yes, or Serena Higgins 2.0 or something like that.
All right, well, returning to the Inklings and King Arthur, what were some of the most exciting experiences involved in getting it published, and maybe what were a few of the most challenging?
Why don't I do the most challenging first so we can end on a more positive note? Mm-hmm. There were the usual challenges involved in editing a large project of this size, communicating with 20 other authors, keeping everyone on timelines, working on deadlines, and then doing a few other little things like getting a PhD that kept me rather busy. Mm-hmm. But the biggest challenge I'll talk about, because hopefully this can be helpful for other scholars, especially emerging scholars who want to know how to do this. The biggest challenge was getting the permissions for the material that's quoted in the book. That's just a time-consuming process, and I didn't start it early enough in the process. So I would do a few things differently in the future. I would ask my authors to limit the number of quotations that they use, which can make for more thoughtful analysis too sometimes. And then I would approach the estate holders and the publishers for permissions earlier in the process. And it's an expensive process as well. So I ended up doing a GoFundMe campaign to raise the money for the permissions fees, and that was one of the highlights. That was one of the really positive experiences, because the community really rallied and gave a lot of support so that this book could come into existence. Two of the other most exciting experiences were, first of all, working with these really wonderful people, these excellent writers, several of whom I've not yet met in person. We've just worked digitally. Others I've met at conferences and Charles Williams Society meetings, and really, really delightful, kind, and generous scholars. That's been wonderful. And then a very exciting experience at the end was getting the cover designed. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you've all seen the really beautiful cover art.
Ah, yes, it is.
It's very, very lovely. I knew from the beginning that I wanted a cover that took the two elements, the Inklings and King Arthur, and wove them together in a clever way, kind of like a visual pun. So the publisher and I decided to use the website 99 Designs, which serves as a go-between to mediate between artists and clients. So I was able to go on there and write a big description of what I wanted, some elements I'd like to see, and then many artists competed in this contest, giving their designs, their design suggestions. And it came down in the end to about a half a dozen, and I did an open poll, and over 200 people voted on their favorite design. And it was really, really close in the end. It came down to just a couple of votes difference. But the winner was Emily Austin, who is a student at Signum University, which is delightful. And she was really fun to work with. She was very responsive. I would send her suggestions, and she would immediately revise the design. So if you haven't seen it yet, it's a really lovely design with a great color scheme, and it's a pipe. And then the pipe mm-hmm. smoke is turning into this scene that has a cup and a sword and a castle and a green hill. You'll notice I'm choosing that phrasing deliberately to draw from The Magician's Nephew. So it takes these two elements and weaves them together into sort of this Arthurian fantasy as dreamed up by the Inklings in community together when they would have been sitting and smoking and drinking and talking and sharing their works together. So that was very exciting. And then it was also a blessing to have the book release party at one of Signum University's regional conferences, TexMoot, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and Emily Austin was able to be there and celebrate the book release with me.
It is a very eye-appealing cover.
Thank you. I'm glad you think so. I do.
Well, now, let's go ahead and wrap up. In closing, give us a final summary of why readers will want to get a copy of The Inklings and King Arthur.
Oh, there's so many different reasons people might like it. It's an excellent work of scholarship that pushes Inkling studies forward in many important critical areas. So if you're an academic, a teacher, a professor, high school, college, or graduate school, and you have any classes that include any of the Inklings' works at all, then you would like this. If you are an Inklings scholar yourself, then you want to join in the conversation and see the new directions that this book is taking Inkling scholarship. But it's not just for academics as well. I really worked with my writers to develop their chapters to be written in sort of a friendly way, a way that can be approached by any interested, committed reader. So you do not have to have a PhD or be a college professor to read this book. Especially, I hope my introduction, my first chapter, and some of the survey chapters are written in a really engaging way that will draw you in. And I would say owning this book is another way of joining and extending the community. There's so many people who have worked on this, from the writers to the peer reviewers, to people who gave me advice and proofread it, and then the endorsements as well. Let me just run through the list of people who have enjoyed and recommended this book. Owen A. Barfield, who's Owen Barfield's grandson, Helen Fulton, a noteworthy Arthurian scholar, Michael Ward, Tom Shippey, Verlin Flieger, Greville Lindop, the Zaleskis. The list goes on and on. Don King, Colin Duryea, Michael Trout, Lyle Dorsett, Janet Croft, Joe Christopher, Corey Olson, John Ratliff, Aaron Rukma, and the Reverend Dr. Rowan Williams. So all of these people have been involved in this conversation already, and by your getting a copy of the book, reading it, writing a review, rating it on Amazon and Goodreads, emailing me about it, you'll be joining the conversation and pushing this forward, because there's a lot more work to be done. This is only the first of several books that could be written on this topic. So let's continue the conversation.
And maybe Serena Higgins 3.0 could be involved in that book, maybe.
That is possible.
Well, thank you, Serena, for being on All About Jack.
Thank you very much, William. It's been a very great delight.
And thank you, my listener, for your interest in All About Jack. a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, and All About Jack is also part of the Theology Mix podcast network. Be sure to check the show notes for any links mentioned during the program. The show notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is most easily found and navigated. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, highlights the most recent show on the main page and also has space dedicated to listing past shows and the notes for them. Additionally, you can find a variety of other material on Lewis at EssentialCSLewis.com, including a popular series that explores quotations attributed to him that may not be from him. When you visit my site, be sure to listen to other interviews and special podcasts on a variety of topics, mostly directly related to Lewis. And in case you didn't know, during the week, I occasionally post previously released podcasts on my iTunes feed that you can also find at the Podbean address. If you don't know how to get to the show on iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link to that. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you do visit me on iTunes, please consider rating my podcast as it can help others find it there. Finally, in case you haven't heard, I have a book called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. It is available online at Amazon. Paperback is $14.99, and at last check, the Kindle edition was just $5.49. Buying the book is a great way to help support my podcast. You can learn more about my book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Thanks again for listening to All About Jack.